The next case is 99-924 Harold Perry York versus Mayfield Neurological Institute.
Therefore, how can the patient?
That's how I read from the record.
It says this procedure can cause death or life.
Do you agree as a doctor, if you assume that the doctor told the degree rate, if the record shows that the doctor testified that he told the patient, even if your client is patient, should that third time?
Because you're not going to die from your bad.
If you truly told the patient that you have a life-threatening condition, because this is your only option, then perhaps so, but that's not going to be back as you're dependent on it, just as long. The whole key is whether he told
There is value to a reasonable person.
Yeah.
There is value in certain cases, you know. Let me twice. Informed consent applies to every operation. There are operations, elective operations, and this one appears on the record, who did one where it could have waited. For example, cosmetic surgery. There's risks of cosmetic surgery. The doctor come in and sit down and tell me, you know, I just read something on life and such. That says, if you have liposuction, you end up black and blue for 3 weeks, you could get dehydrated, and there's other risks like death, etc. Now, when a doctor tells me that, as a reasonable person, I might say, yes or no, people do it every day. Where nipples, we get nipples, that also kills you out, I'll bring up a nipple, involves a situation of a life-threatening situation where there appears to be no option. The patient was not told of a very remote consequence. In this case, the patient said, I was not told of a consequence that was direct and very material risk, not to admit it. If I had been told of that risk, I would not have gone through this operation. There is no evidence that says he would have. There's no evidence that says a reasonable man would have undergone something.
But isn't the reason for the third branch of the Nichols test to take the subjectivity out of this sort of case, the situation where it's likely that the person, the patient now who's had this happen to him is going to say, well, if you told me, I would have decided to do something different than I did. I guess I don't understand why the trial judge had such a, as the Court of Appeals found, while the trial judge had such a difficult time with a rule that says if you offer an interrogatory that goes to the issue, then it has to be given to the jury. Here, the interrogatory tracks the third branch of the third paragraph, the third branch of the Nichols test. How is the trial judge why did the trial judge not abuse his discretion?
Here's the record, Your Honor. The trial judge says, I feel this is confusing and redundant to issues I've already addressed.
The Court of Appeals says it is not. And I guess my question is, why is it redundant when it's citing one of the three tests that this court has said you must give to a jury?
Your Honor, I think the best judge of the three. Reach that wrong. You get the patient that he was not informed. Because if you don't believe the patient, he's guilty. Jury believes he's cancer than a rock. Yes. You then have to find that as a proximate cause of not being informed, he suffered daily. The jury said yes, the risk of material. Now, in order to get to the third prong, the jury has to say, we believe the patient, we believe he wasn't informed, we believe all of it. However,
They
put out a 1-2 in our favor, they don't have to answer the third question. It's harmless error. I think what the trial court realized is in order to find that our client would have the operation anyway, they have to believe our client on everything except that testimony, and then while they disbelieve the doctor's version, I gave you all the risks, but they have to believe that despite the fact the doctor wrote Dr. Dunkel and said repeatedly, this is not life-threatening, observation is an option. That really wasn't true, that this was so life-threatening, the patient had to handle it, and any reasonable patient would have. To reach that to this record, it's a real strength. with Nichols. Nichols does not, I don't think that sort of fraud in Nichols is particularly applicable to what we would call a leftist circuit reform, certainly not a choice.
Counsel, I'm not sure. I think you get that, unless you agree. What your argument is why this interrogatory should not be given in this case. There was a factual dispute as to whether or not the doctor advised your client of the risks of surgery. There was a big time factual dispute on that. But what you're saying, there was not a factual dispute on the issue of whether or not failing to have surgery that the doctor advised your client, failing to have the surgery would resolve a certain death.
That's correct, doctor.
That if in fact that was his medical status, your client's medical status, I think if you can see, it would, the reasonable man would opt for the surgery at that point, and you would fail on that prong. But what you're saying is it wasn't in the case because neither your side nor the other side presented any evidence that surgery was a necessity.
He then later in the trial says, well, he would have doubled, he would have all these problems, but he never told the patient that. He never, and he admitted it. He
wasn't like
that.
So at the trial, that was the status, but at the trial he also acknowledged that he never told the patient that the patient was in that kind of peril. So there's confusion as to what the jury could consider is the reasonable man's analysis of this medical condition at the point that the surgery was to be elective.
Well, there's confusion plus the doctor himself admitted at trial that this condition was not life-threatening at the time. It could have been as long as 4 years before anything developed. He just, you know, if you read the actual testimony, as far as I'm on page 600, he says the tumor is not life-threatening at that time. It might, you know, I think it would have doubled, and he may have had blindness, and then it would have gotten too big, he may have had paralysis or dementia. But at that time,
what was his testimony as to what he told patient with respect to his options on the surgery, at the point of the surgery? I mean, was he saying to him, no, it's not life-threatening now, but if you let this go 4 years from now, it's going to be a very tough, it could be life-threatening, and the surgery would be extremely difficult.
He did not tell that patient. He told the patient, he said, I explained the risks. He didn't remember a whole lot about what he did tell the patient, but I explained the risks of the surgery, not the risks of not having it right. They explained that observation was an option, but thought it might be best to go ahead with the surgery now. And that's what he said to Dr. Dunn. Never put a letter.
Who has the burden going forward on that surgery?
I believe the defense is going
to be as a reasonable man.
I believe it's an affirmative defense on this. The patient considers himself a reasonable man.
I think the doctor, if the patient says, I would not have, had I been advised, I would not have gone forward, that's enough. You've got trying to fix your case.
Again, I believe so, particularly on this fact pattern where the patient says, it's not by threatening, observation is wrong. You know, it's one thing the patient says, I'm going to do this right now in this operation, but if I've been told that I could have a stroke out of it, I would have never had it. that might be, you know, thought of carrying a burden. But the totality of circumstances is where the patient's told, this is not how you put it, observation sound. I mean, so if you don't want to go back and have stroke out of this, I wouldn't have done it. I think that needs standard. And the doctor's going to show why he should have had it, even though it wasn't life-threatening observation, an option. And you got to come forth and sub out this reasonable manslaughter. Particularly when you're talking about a procedure that at that point is elective and not mandatory.
Counsel, did the jury find in favor of the doctor in this case as far as malpractice is concerned?
They found that there was no negligence in the operation itself.
Am I then to take it that cutting the carotid artery and clamping it off is a risk that you assume when you have this operation taken?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. There is a risk of that. My client said he was never advised. The doctor did not advise him of that.
He didn't advise him that he may cut the carotid artery and he may get a stroke from that? Is
no,
that what he was not a... Well, I'm sure that the doctor didn't mean to cut the carotid artery, did he?
No, I don't think anybody, you know... I don't believe he meant to cut the carotid artery.
But that wasn't a risk that was known to this type of operation?
For what the evidence was in trial, yes, that is a risk.
Okay, so the jury found that he didn't do anything negligent. They only found that he didn't inform the patient that these possibilities were there.
That is correct.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Evans.
We represent Dr. John Jr. and the
was 2-1, wasn't it?
It was. I can only...
You had a pretty well-reasoned dissent, wasn't there?
With all due respect to the judge sitting as a retired judge who was on this particular panel with me, the Chief Justice, I think it's a rather mystifying.
Mystifying?
Mystifying.
Why he was assigned or what?
I'm confident that he was assigned for a second. The opinion is that it was to us. And the reason is simply this, that the NICLE standard, the NICLE test, very clear, is covered in the jury instructions. This particular point about reasonable man is covered very briefly. But interrogatories then, under Rule 49, track them and were tendered at the right time, and they were rejected. For the wrong reason, the trial judge has rejected, makes clear that he misread.
Just for the purposes of argument, accept, if you will, that, and for, of course you don't have to because you will, the interrogatory was proper in all respects, and pursuant to 49B probably should have been given. Accept that for argument. I would have asked that to the other side before their time ran out. If you don't give it, can you correct it in the general instruction? I mean, can you cover it in the general instruction and say, because I've done that before, and I've said, I'm going to already take care of this in the general instruction and tell the lawyers what the general instruction is going to be. Can you cover it that way?
I don't think so.
You think you have to give it?
It may be that people could disagree with me about that. I don't think so. But just what I do think is this. If you say these are the three prongs in the standard, having that to the jury was their failure to disclose risk, and did one of those risks eventuate? And what are the plaintiff's damages? If you ask them in that way, the right answer to the questions, you invite the jury to forget about the little sentence, which took about 10 words and the longer instruction.
Yeah.
And that's what the Court of Appeals found. And that's very clearly why there was an error in the case, and that's why it was a reversal error, and that's why they gave that legal benefit in trial.
Well, now, if you gave the general charge and concluded the entire test, and there were no alarm or issues with the verdict system, you know, that error.
I think that the answer to that is that Rule 49 allows you the party to test the verdict. And certainly the judge's decision not to allow part of the interrogatory would have been much less grievous if he'd stricken the whole set. Absolutely. I think that the weight in this case is the worst possible outcome. But under this court's decision, I don't intend to do that. So you can simply say, I'm going to be a clearinghouse if they're wrong. If they're wrong in these phrases or so forth, but if they're mistaken, I'm not going to let them. The judge can have that discretion. But that's not the case.
Under Rule 49, the court is obliged to give any instruction for which relevant evidence has been propounded. It seems that counsel for the appellant here is arguing that the evidence wasn't there to support that prong of the Gonzalez-Nichols test. So what did he say on that subject?
Well, first of all, Nichols versus Gonzalez was the applicable standard.
Anyway.
The counsel is saying that you should change Nichols after 15 years. But let's go beyond that. This is a case where Dr. Tu, great neurosurgeon, nobody's going to dispute that, has seen Mr. York since 1985. When he first saw him in 1985, and he had a tumor behind his right eye the size of a pea. He saw him again in 1992. He had a tumor behind his right eye the size of a golf ball. It was doubling in size. It was to double in size every 2 years. By 1994, when the case went to trial, the tumor would have been the size of a baseball.
But the argument, and we don't read the record in advance of the oral argument, so we don't know, but they did. There seems to be a disagreement about this evidence about the increase in size in the golf ball and the eventuality of blindness, et cetera, was never disclosed, as well as the risks were never disclosed of the surgery.
And that's what they're contending.
But, I mean, do you disagree that evidence was, the evidence at trial from Dr. Tu was that he did indeed discuss the increase in the size of the tumor and the potential, or the eventuality that the blindness, et cetera, would be upon this patient?
There's no question in pages 602 to 606 of the record, Dr. Tu's testimony on those points are very clear.
Having said it before trial, that he said it to the patient.
What is clear from what he said before trial, and it was hotly disputed, and the trial was there was a courtroom clearing incident about this, and it was a matter of considerable hubbub in the trial court, and he testified that he disclosed the various risks, and he testified at some length about what those risks were. He also testified, by the way, the only expert to testify at trial, about what he found in the course of the surgery and so forth. And he has that additional perspective that any expert would.
Mm-hmm.
And when you address this issue about what is a reasonable person supposed to do in the situation, which I think is very common.
But what he found at surgery would be very much beside the point, wouldn't it?
I believe not.
Why not?
Because it would be additional information as to the risk confronting the patient at the time. And the third prong of Nichols, in my estimation, is also to say whether or not there's really any injury here. Not only does it sort of keep the patient honest because he's bound to forget, you know, the videotapes of all the informed consent discussions demonstrate a high percentage of people don't remember things, but it also says what was the patient confronted with at the time of making the decision. And so an expert comes up to the problem, we look at...
So you say the realities of it, the realities would prevent a patient who hadn't been properly informed from being said to have been injured,
yes,
even without the information.
That's right. That's right. I think that's a second form of the problem.
So, following up on what Justice Cook was asking, it's still a little unclear to me from your answer whether or not there is agreement or dispute as to what the patient was told with respect to the downside of refusing the surgery. Not what the patient was told about the risks of the surgery, but what the patient was told in advance of the surgery, about what is likely to happen to the patient if they reject the surgery.
And
is there agreement or dispute?
There's a dispute. Certainly we don't agree with what Mr. Evans has represented.
As to what the state of the evidence is.
That's correct.
And what do you say the doctor testified, or the jury was told, that the doctor told the patient in advance of the decision to make the surgery about the consequences of failure.
What we believe that the record supports is that Dr. Tu made the patient aware that he had a rapidly growing tumor, and that the tumor was not life-threatening at that moment. We believe that is also the record. But that the doctor was saying, we recommend you deal with this man because this tumor can become inoperable and because you have, as you know, a heart condition. And that heart condition, and it's in the record, the heart condition would have rendered him not a candidate for this kind of surgery by the time of trial. That's what the record supports. Dr. Chu discussing with him, and Dr. Duncan, there's a letter that Mr. Evans made reference to, that Dr. Duncan says, he can't observe it if he wants to, but we recommend he deal with it now. And the point is this, really, that the record is so hot about that issue, and it's doubled kind of repeatedly, and it's easy to become confused about what you think of one any person that sort of says. The point is this, Dr. Tu didn't get her trial on this issue. And all of that should have gone to the jury. That issue about the reasonable man standards and what the patient was confronted with should have been handled by the jury fairly. And it couldn't have been because the little lady interrogatory was not only excluded but then ultimately guilty.
We're not asked to decide this, but who picks up where it's the burden from going forward on that issue, and it is the point of correct that they can present patient's view of this, and that's enough to shift the burden over to the defense then on a reasonable man test.
I think first of all, satisfying the three prongs of Nickler, clearly the plaintiff's burden of proof, because he had the burden of proving those things, and the standard. The case law is fairly clear that the reasonable man is an objective standard, which takes it away from him. I mean, his testimony is interesting, but it's really not dispositive at all.
Is his testimony probative at all? I mean, is it like the landowner who is always regarded as an expert on the value of their own property? Is the patient's testimony probative enough so that if that's all you have, you're there?
It's very interesting, Your Honor. I know that Your Honor has been, I believe, involved in a case where expert testimony is required. There, in a range of surgery procedures, there are obviously instances where the patient's testimony is probative, where he is able to make a judgment because he knows stuff. He knows, like Mr. Evans says, whether he wants to have surgery to reduce his waistline. He knows about those kind of risks and can evaluate them. Probably doesn't know about what's going on with the tumor behind your brain, and the expert testimony of the tumor certainly should be more important than his own testimony from that point. So I think there's one rule on that. But the reasonable man standard doesn't provide this severe, give everybody up. activity, so that you can't come in after the fact and say, I never would have that done.
Mr. Hall, one more question. The trial court, at least when you read the record, it's the trial court seems to reject the third interrogatory from Nichols Gonzalez on the basis that it is confusing. And the interrogatory does vary from the syllabus of Nichols in some slight ways. The language was adjusted as proposed to the court. Now, if the court finds it confusing, what standard of review do we use to say, to determine whether or not, I mean, is it just a de novo review? Was that indeed confusing, or is there does the court get discretion in that? How do we judge that?
I don't think there's much of a difference between a de novo review and an abuse of discretion on that little point, because what both the trial court and the reviewing court are doing is looking at a little syllabus of law and saying whether faithful to it or not. And as the Court of Appeals said, well, you know, that there's word that in there and it refers to him, the plaintiff. The judge alone did not do that when he said he didn't like this in Rockford. He said it refers to any reasonable man, and that's not the test.
Yeah.
I mean, the trial judge didn't object to it because it was not the problem.
He said he found it confusing, which a court need not offer an interrogatory that is confusing. And the court didn't have the obligation to change it. You know, he takes it as proposed, and counsel for your side didn't offer to change it. I take it because you would rather have taken the shot on it's not confusing, which is where you are now.
I think looking back, since I didn't try the case with Mr. Evans, and I would give the judge the same grace as I give defense counsel, which was, it was a heated moment, and they were at a charge conference, and things were going against my counsel in the trial court, and he submitted the interrogatory and decided to let go. In retrospect, I might have said, you know, we should pull the whole set or something over our objections, because it made it much worse. But I think that this court can look at the interrogatory and decide how close it was, and so close. I don't really have a problem.
You use your time, Mr. Hall.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We ask the Court of Appeals decision be affirmed.
Mr. Evans, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Very briefly, Your Honor, three pages 600-606.
Correct.
That is where Dr. Two describes all these life threatening conditions, all these conditions he says later on with threatened life. There is not one word in those 6 pages where he said I ever told Harold Perry about those risks of not having a surgery. It was 600.
Just as a matter of curiosity and no other reason, it can be a short answer. How do you nick the artery in the neck when you're operating behind the eye?
Well, he said that when he got in there, he found the tumor near the carotid artery, and he had a big explanation, and he went to remove that part too, and he nicked the carotid artery.
Okay.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.